Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a good one, huh, Stone?
Hey, this is going to be a lot of fun. You know, everyone in the studio this morning are returning guests, and so no strangers to the Business Radio X microphone. A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to catch up with Constance. And, you know, I'm not even going to try to pronounce your last name. Constance, how do you pronounce your last name?
Derricks.
Oh, okay. So it's easier to pronounce than it is to read.
Don't look at it, and you're fine. Just don't look at it.
So Constance is going to get us caught up with her efforts out at CD Consulting Group. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to reintroduce two gentlemen from Root Radius, founder and creative director Josh Webb and president, director of client experience, Joe Garcia. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thank you very much.
We are delighted to have you. So let's dive right in, if we could. Can you just get us a little bit of a primer? What are you guys out there trying to do for folks? What's your mission and purpose?
Absolutely. Well, we specifically work with causes to tell their story. And a little bit of the purpose behind that is if you're familiar with working with causes, a lot of times you'll find that if you just ask a simple question, what do you do? They may find themselves saying things like, well, what don't I do? I do everything around here. And then they start talking more about their job and how hard it is to be a nonprofit and things like that. And then you kind of step away from the mission. And so we equip causes to tell their story and not only tell it, but actually go inside of their organization to make the story that they're telling true letting them implement practices and even systems to actually make that story more prevalent to the people that they're trying to accomplish it with.
So sometimes you find these causes aren't authentic?
It's not that they're not authentic. They're actually usually extremely authentic. It's just that it's very difficult sometimes. Think about if you're working with cancer, right? So the normal person, like, they hear cancer and it's very vague. But there we have people that are working in very specific pieces of cancer and the research that goes in behind it. And when they go and ask for a donation, a lot of times that kind of seems like a black hole. And so by really clarifying their story and actually explaining simple things like the actual problem they're solving, the actual solution that they actually provide and how that goes about solving it and what they actually need from people, it becomes, there's a tremendous amount of clarity that comes from that then it makes it a little easier to give. And so that's what we help our clients with.
So sometimes that maybe the founders know what the mission is and that's not kind of being disseminated through their own people.
Yeah, because mission a lot of times can be it's, you know, you end up with these mission statements that are very long that nobody really understands,
right,
even
and
internally.
You can't even mix and match. You can't match the mission statement to the organization a lot of the times.
Oh yeah, and they a lot of times they all seem the same. It's right. Like, you know, we try to achieve quality by helping the world with problems.
Our people are the most important thing.
Exactly. So by having a unique clarified mission, they find that not only can they explain it better, but they even understand internally how to approach their practices, and as a nonprofit, doing that with business is actually really important.
Now, Joe, can you share maybe a before and after example?
Yeah, I'd love to. So there was an organization that we've helped and we've seen experience tremendous growth. So they were a startup, and just the founder was extremely passionate. In fact, she's been a guest, I think, on Business Radio X, Sarah Buchanan from the Kula Project. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was just had this heart and passion to serve people, and they did a little bit of this and they did a little bit of that and everything. And what she found was everybody said, oh, that's sweet. You're doing a great work.
That sounds important.
Yeah. But the legitimacy of the organization, the credibility, and the ability, if you're riding a couple floors on an elevator, to say, so what do you do? I do this, or we exist too. And being able to tell that story in a repeatable way over and over and over and over again to saturate the market with, that's this organization, they do this, as opposed to leaving it up for somebody to just say, oh yeah, I met Sarah or I met Joe. I think he does something with whatever,
right? You
know, and they formulate their own idea. So And we say we want to create a message for these organizations that's so simple from the founder of the organization down to a first-time volunteer can say the exact same thing. So what we've seen over working with her and that organization, for example, over the last couple of years is they've gotten incredible traction in the marketplace, incredible media exposure, and now everyone understands exactly what it is they are doing, and people are partnering with them and getting behind them in a big way, and they've experienced tremendous growth.
Can you share their mission?
Sure. So they invest in small-scale farmers to create sustainable communities.
So it really is repeatable. Because that's one of the questions I had. That sounds like that makes a lot of sense. How do you make it repeatable? Are there like three key disciplines that you have to exercise so that you make a message repeatable?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, when we conduct strategy sessions for our clients, I just like to sit back and watch the magic happen because Josh, with his background and his ability to take something that's extremely complicated and distill it down to one sentence, and everybody's nodding their head in the room and going, yes, that's what we do. And all he's doing is pulling that story and that information out of them. He's not creating it for them from scratch. That's where I kind of feel like that's a little bit of the magic kingdom going on there.
Well, I won't take all the credit for it. What's great is that we have a network of strategists that we work with that all kind of have that kind of talent, the ability to be able to take a lot of complex information and make it simple for people. But really what we focus on is a lot of specifically what the problem is that they're solving. We'll actually have them look at the problem as if no solution exists. It's just something that we're just trying to create a solution to these different kinds of problems. So there'll be symptoms, all these different kind of things, and we try to find the similarities and come up with the problem. And then we go into the solution, and the solution, a lot of times, they try to say, well, our solution is we have these 17 programs that solve this, and this is how it works. And it's not 17 programs. Your solution looks a little bit more like a mission, and we try not to call it a mission statement because they're so tied to the one that they can't remember.
Right.
But we look at the solution as, okay, if you said this was the problem, let's try to figure out your processes, all these different kinds of things, and find the similarity to the actual problem that they're solving. And then there's a story that starts to formulate. Then we put the offerings in, and that's all the things that they know that they've been telling people. How do we actually do that? Here are the 5 things we do, or the 17 programs that include that. And then what are we actually asking people to do? Because you'd be surprised at how many times you can tell somebody a story and you don't expect them to buy it. And then the first time they buy it, they go, okay, what do you want me to do? And you're like, oh, I don't know. I didn't think about it.
Right. We didn't think that far.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have that whole all set. And then we start to just look at it as it's almost storytelling ingredients in which you know so well that depending on how the conversation's going or depending on what marketing medium you're using, you know which one to put in at what time. And that's what we end up doing with all of the support. We provide beautiful supportive designs and a lot of marketing automation that we put around to actually build some of their donations. And we now have that core story that we can use throughout all those elements.
Now, when you got into this, was it surprising to you that so many nonprofits and cause-driven organizations lack the clarity?
It really was. I have a history of I've been a creative director at advertising agencies for the last 10 years. And so I was working for Universal Studios and Under Armour and UPSs and places like that. And what I found in the business space is that if you didn't have a clear story, you like couldn't even compete. It wasn't a question of whether you're going to stay in business.
Right, this was like make or break kind of table stakes, right?
Yeah, if you want to come to the table and actually compete, then you at least have a core story,
right?
But with causes, they have a purpose, and they usually start pretty pretty grassroots, and so they usually gain this influence just from the personal out, and so they have that for them, and a lot of times it doesn't require a good story to get started. And that's why they never go further. They go, oh, we seem to be doing okay. But they don't see that the opportunity costs are there. And so what I found with when we first started talking, I mean, I must have interviewed when we first started this business about 30 causes, up from American Cancer Society down to somebody who was just starting things. And the inability for them to get out of a department or to not think of task-driven things it blew me away. And what I saw, I remember the first time I saw a charity called Charity Water. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but the amount of clarity that they had come to the marketplace, they weren't the only people working in water, but the fact that they told the story right, the fact that it was transparent, the fact that it was beautiful, all the things that they put in place made it explode. So because of the purpose that's behind a nonprofit, when you get the story right and you can actually be transparent and internally you're proving the story, it actually has the potential to explode versus a business that's just like, okay, now we get to be at the table.
So now, because of this clarity and because of this expertise, is that why you position yourself as an expert in cause rather than, I mean, because these same tactics would work for any business, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it helps. I steer away from the word expert because everything changes so often. But I definitely think that allowing yourself to focus on one particular area, I think one reason we focus there is just, it's the work we want to do. You know, I've spent a lot of time working with businesses. I love businesses. I like the capitalism. But in terms of just the work we want to do, we want to be doing purposeful, meaningful work mm-hmm. and helping, you know, the humans. And so with that really comes us going after them. But what we've seen as an advantage for our company is that where everybody would say, yeah, we do marketing for everyone and marketing is universal. Right. It's actually really helped us to say, no, you know, for the last almost 5 years now, we've done almost exclusively cause marketing, almost exclusively fundraising, and even going in for the marketing pieces just for nonprofits. And so we see all the trends and we are able to react based on even all of our clients being causes themselves.
Now, with the recent economic downturn, we saw, at least in here, some consolidation with a lot of cause marketing firms. A lot of them dropped by the wayside because they couldn't, you know, I guess, have clarity in their mission and kind of get the donations they need to fulfill their mission. Did you see any of that?
Well, I think the organizations that are telling a really clear and compelling story that inspire people to act
have less problems.
And I think they're attracting more donors. I think it has to do with people just being really tired of giving to some charitable black hole. They want to know that their dollar is making a difference and that as many marketing dollars as you spent on telling the story and asking me for that gift, you're going to spend some dollars on reporting the results and sharing the impact.
Right.
And I'm of the opinion that the people that are reporting the results and sharing the impact, they're miles ahead of everyone else because everyone else is just rattling the cup asking for your money and they do a poor job at best of telling you where it actually went. So the causes that we serve, we come into the conversation with that attitude to say, report the results, say thank you, show the impact, do those three things and tell a really great story. And you're going to see some magic happen within your organization and in, you know, the community that you're asking people to get involved with that is going to blow you away. And you're going to go, why is this working? And so that's what we've seen.
So now that level of transparency, is that one of the trends you're seeing moving forward for nonprofits?
I think they have to. I think people are just, it's just unacceptable now to not share the financials of the organization, to not show where the money is going, to not show the impact that you're making. You know, I guess you'd call that a trend. I almost think it's a mandate. If somebody's willing to give you some of their hard-earned money, you owe it to them at a minimum to tell them what you're going to do with the money and how it's affecting people's lives.
Yeah, I'll add to that as well. There's also innovation happening in the space where the reason we call them causes and not just, you know, 501c3 nonprofits is because people are getting smarter about how to help people. And so they're starting businesses. They're starting businesses, you know, like your Tom Shoes, those kinds of things.
Like socially conscious businesses?
Yeah. So there's a lot of businesses that we work with that exclusively exist to help people in a certain way.
That aren't nonprofit.
They're not nonprofit. But there's, you know, for instance, in Orlando, a B Corp is a new kind of entity that has shown up that actually allows you to have some tax incentives but still like receive investor money, things like that. And so there's these startups that are coming up all over the place that we work with too, that think like a business, run like a business. They actually make a profit. They're not scared. They don't have to run they don't have to basically rattle the tin cup and mm-hmm. beg for money all the time. And therefore they're actually able to be more successful and still really help those people. And so we love that idea and we consider ourselves one of those even.
So that, are there donations involved on companies like that?
Not typically. I think that they're looking for commerce ways to create those dollars. But you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Sevenly. Is a t-shirt mm-hmm. company. They basically have a cause a week that they make a t-shirt for, and then $7 of every t-shirt goes to the charity that they're representing. Now, this is an expensive t-shirt. It's $27, right?
Right.
But when you add the cause marketing side, when you start saying things like, you know what, I don't need to wear that many t-shirts, and maybe if I buy a t-shirt, I'm gonna always make sure it supports a cause. I think that's what we're seeing, a trend in society even. And the fact that these businesses have seen that, they're actually allowing themselves to innovate in the space and start going, you know what, I'll be completely transparent. I'll create a great brand, but I won't have to convince people to go help people. instead, I'll just give them something they want.
I'll just build that into the into the product or service.
Exactly.
And so then the person feels good. You know, $20 for a t-shirt, $27 doesn't matter that much, you know, in the scope of things. And this way I'm helping that cause. So I feel good about myself.
Well, and I think there's this whole trend of purposeful living too. You know, why do people shop at Whole Foods? You know, they want to eat healthy. They want to be green. You know, why do they wear certain clothes? Why do they buy their coffee from, you know, local coffee shops that aren't big, giant, mega public companies? You know, so there's a movement toward that. And so as nonprofits catch on and they engage in income generating activity, as well as specifically nonprofits, as well as normal routes of donations and corporate sponsorships and all that, that's an innovation, I think, that's happening in the nonprofit space. And even 2 or 3 years from now, the ones that are really doing that well, I think they're going to be getting the lion's share of even charitable money.
So Lee asked earlier in the conversation about similar application to the private sector. And I know during your entire segment, Constance and I are both like nodding our head up and down like, yeah, that applies. That applies. I'm taking notes. So related to that, is there a role for marketing automation in your arena? Because there certainly seems to be, in general business.
Yeah, I think definitely from storytelling, I think that there is overall in the private sector, the ability to tell your story clearly is a requirement. And even furthermore, the ability to be able to bring your story inside of your organization and actually have it permeate the entire culture. And you just kind of brought up the idea of marketing automation. And I think that one thing that we find is that when someone tells your story, you essentially are giving a promise, right? You're saying that, number one, I'm telling you the story. It's not just my story. It's actually a true story, right? And there's some trust that needs to take place there. And so so when you start, the problem with a business or even a nonprofit is that when they go inside their organization, they get so busy with trying to run it that they don't actually create the experience that then proves that. And so, you know, something like automation for both businesses and nonprofit allows them to create an intentional experience that proves that brand story. With things like saying, these are the tasks that every single time that someone signs up with us, these are the tasks that are going to happen. Here's the emails they're going to get. This very intentional experience, which then actually proves the story to them over time. And so what we've begun to do in kind of the future of some of the services that we're offering is that we're not only helping tell the story, we're also going inside the organization to help automate a lot of the marketing that they're doing and a lot of the workflow practices that we're doing so that they can actually go and be more personal with people and actually go and have personal conversations while all of the communications is continuing to happen and all of the workflow that they have inside their organization is still improving. And so that's some of the things that we're focusing on. And we've actually seen more trust come from customers in the private sector, but also for donors in the nonprofit sector experiencing that. It's become true to them. They've heard the story. They then experienced it, and it was like absolutely true. So now they're fans.
So now what I'm hearing is that this constant, the hard part, I guess, at first is being clear on the story, right? You have to, the story could exist in a kind of a disjointed manner historically, and then you help them kind of fine-tune the story so that it can be repeated easily by anybody, any of the constituents,
right?
That's step one in this process.
Yeah, and it's important to distinguish too that the founder or the president, sometimes they're a really great communicator, which that can get a little weird for them. They go, no, I got a story. I'm great. Yeah. Whenever they tell it, it's really good. No one else knows how to tell it. Nobody else knows what's going on. And maybe people don't even understand it. They just enjoy hearing them speak because they're so good at speaking.
He's compelling.
Hey, he told like 10 jokes. I really got it. What did he say? I don't know.
I have no idea. But so once you have that framework, then you help them kind of tell that story and maybe other stories that kind of exemplify the core of that story throughout the year in a campaign fashion?
Yeah, it really comes down to three things. We help them tell their story through strategy, helping them figure out what their story is and how they're going to implement it inside and outside their organization.
Right.
Then we have a creative team that provides beautiful materials as well as really great messages, websites, and email campaigns, all these kind of things. And now automation has become this true next point where we're now automating their workflow and automating their marketing so that they can actually have more leads in the funnel and actually create better results. The three of those has been this like crazy trifecta where when they actually do it and spend some time and let it get better and better over the course of a year or so, we've seen some really great results.
I had a question about the story because you're talking about the story. And sometimes I work with corporations and some not-for-profits, but sometimes people have a story. But it's not a good story.
Yeah.
It's not an effective story, mm-hmm. but everybody knows it. Everybody repeats it. It's their mantra, but it doesn't precipitate any of the results. Mm-hmm. So what are the characteristics of a great story and how does it distinguish itself from one that's a real yawner?
That's a great question. What I typically try to look for, I think that's where you get insight. Right. So there's some things that can be true. So, for instance, you can just say there is cancer and that's true. And you can say and there are lots of kinds of cancer and it is bad and people die. And that's also true. But then there's insights that you can come from it. And that takes you maybe having dealt with people with cancer and seeing as like, you know, or had a mom with cancer or something like that. And you start to see an insight whenever you see a really great commercial. A lot of times what you've seen is that someone had a fantastic insight about an audience, and they were able to create a story from it. My best example I can use, have you guys seen the How to Dad commercial that Peanut Butter Cheerios put on? Okay. It's a fantastic commercial. Look it up on YouTube. You haven't found it. Just look up How to Dad. Okay. So in that terms, we got people trying to sell peanut butter Cheerios, and I wasn't in the boardroom, but essentially they go, okay, we've already got these peanut butter Cheerios in production, right?
We have a warehouse full.
Yeah. But we went and interviewed a bunch of moms. And they went, I'm not buying my kids peanut butter Cheerios. And they're about to shut down the factory. They go, what do we do? And so they start having these kind of conversations. And then where you can start to lead back is yes, the truth is we have peanut butter Cheerios that we're trying to sell. What problem does it solve? I don't really know. People want to eat pure peanut butter because it tastes good? I don't know. But you start to work your way back. And what they said is, okay, we have this good cereal that we're trying to sell, right? We have moms who are typically the shopper who don't particularly want to buy this particular product because it's not healthy. So who would buy it? Well, dads would because they're stupid and they don't know what to buy their kid.
Yeah,
and,
that's perfect. Right?
But
I love it.
The kid wants it.
Sure.
He'll be the hero.
But here's the insight that led to a fantastic campaign. The insight is it's not a bad dad. It's a superhero dad. It's a dad that's great for their kids. And so the How to Dad campaign is talking about all the things that dads do for their kids and all these kind of things. And it's all focused on how to be a great dad. And at the very end, and so I buy – that's why Peanut Butter Cheerios is the official sponsor of How to Dad. Okay, that's brilliant. And that only comes from insight. And so when you have a story that can clearly tell the problem, clearly tells the solution, clearly lays out what the actual offering is and what you want people to do, but is surrounded by some sort of insight that people can relate to – that's what
and it's
lays
emotional.
Out a good story. Hopefully that insight's emotional. Hopefully it's not like, and we are a cause.
So now, if you were to give some tips for people that are trying to develop their own story internally, what would they be?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the number one, I'd tell you to go to rootradius.com. We have an ebook there called Passion Vomit. Some people hate that term, but it's a really good example of the dissertations.
We can't figure out why it didn't sell a million copies.
I'll never forget it. I'm telling you.
So you can download that ebook at rootradius.com, but and that'll actually walk you through how to tell a compelling story. But I think the biggest thing that I would focus on is trying to remember the problem that existed as if you didn't have a solution. I mean, don't even talk about organizational talk. Don't say it's not problems with the organization itself. It's the problem that existed that needed your company or needed your nonprofit to exist. This works great with startups. It also works really well with people that have been around for 100 years. And then from that, then start to take in every single thing that you've started to provide and try to look at an insight between the solution that you provide and the problem. And that's when you start to get creative and say, well, you know what we're really doing is we're, I don't know, we're helping people be better people. We're helping them solve greater problems. You're going to start to come up with things that you've language you've never said before, just in order to talk about solution. And then start to get into, and here are the offerings that we provide. And
so the offerings are secondary.
The offerings are, think of them as features for an iPhone. It's not the iPhone. It's not the reason the iPhone exists. But there's a bunch of apps in your iPhone that make the iPhone like worth having. That I need to know that I can do email and I need to know I can do that kind of stuff. But features are not what sell people on things. Mm-hmm. Features are commodities. They're also on the Android. But that's not. There's a feeling that comes with the story.
And then you help your clients get to the heart of that.
Exactly.
All right. So if our listeners would like to learn more, reach out, have a conversation with you guys, and talk on some of these topics, what's the best way? You mentioned the website. Please mention that again.
Yeah, rootradius.com is the place to go, especially get that ebook. At rootradius is we're on Twitter as at rootradius. On Instagram is at rootradius. And you can also find us on Facebook at @rootradius.
Well, thank you both for joining us in the studio this morning. It has been an absolute delight for me. We'd love to have you back sometime. Keep us caught up. And, you know, we're sincere when we say that.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much.
So I got to tell the whole group and our listeners, the real takeaway for me from that segment was this idea of insight. And now I got to get on the phone after our show and tell our social media amplification folks to include the How to Dad link. Did you say it's on the YouTube?
Oh, yeah. Just look up How to Dad. You'll find it.
All right. So so we'll get that done. And this is no reflection on you, Lee, but the question that prompted that for me was from our next guest.
Perfect.
It wasn't from you. So I'm glad we have her in the studio. So please join me in welcoming, if you would, back in the studio, president of CD Consulting Group, Miss Constance Derricks. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I had so much fun last time.
You decided to come back.
I did.
Take another swing.
I did.
So now, why don't you update our listeners to what you're up to, what your story is.
What my story is that I help my clients achieve dramatic growth. And I do that in a variety of ways. Most recently, I've been working with an organization, a large company, a $20 billion company that made an acquisition that was sizable, about $400 million. And I worked with the leader that they assigned to make this profitable and successful. And all of you at the table probably know that in the M&A world, 83% is an off-quoted number of how many deals failed to deliver the value that all the analytical geniuses told them it would, and, you know, the overused word synergy. Mm-hmm. And so my clients are smart, and they said, help this guy make sure the deal works. So I've been working on that, and I'm really happy to say that just last week I learned their final 2014 numbers, and they have blown the results out of the water.
So they're in the top 17%?
They're in the top 1%. It's the most successful deal I've ever worked on, and I've been doing this a long time. The prior deal that I worked on that I formerly referred to as the most successful was, I can name it. This one I can't. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you who it is, but it was... who's in Europe, a company called Benckiser. You guys know that product, Jet Dry, that goes in your dishwasher?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, Benckiser makes Jet Dry.
I like that stuff.
You know. Yeah, oh, do. Oh,
no
good.
No spots on my dishes.
Buy more.
That's another super dad tip right
yeah,
there.
Yeah, there you go.
Jet Dry. Da-da-da.
How to dad.
That's right, how to dad. Load the dishwasher. So Benckiser merged with a company called Reckitt & Coleman, and Reckitt & Coleman is an old English company. They make Lysol. So now you have Lysol and Jet Dry and, you know, a bunch of other things coming together. And I worked with the very talented CEO, Bart Becht, on that deal, and the share price doubled in 2 years. That's pretty unheard of. So yeah. I'm really proud of my clients.
So now what are you doing today?
Well, I'm here.
Right.
Recovering from a cold.
Welcome.
She's the decision doctor.
And
so
right.
Tell us, obviously you've earned that reputation. You're the decision doctor, well, and that suggests to me that maybe most of us could use some real help, and maybe we're not making great decisions. Huh?
Well, right. Absolutely. And I, as your prior guests were speaking, I was thinking of all the decision points, you know, within these various scenarios with their clients. So the decision doctor, it's funny, people say, well, how did you come to call yourself that? And I said, well, I don't. My clients did. But I thought it was so genius that I trademarked it, so you can have it. And what I do is I help clients make important decisions. But the second thing I do is I help them realize the decisions they're making that they don't realize they're making. And my background academically is that I'm a clinical psychologist. So, you know, asking questions, helping clients realize that people don't buy based on information. They buy based on emotion. You don't buy a car because of the horsepower necessarily. Well, maybe some guys do. But you really buy the car because the salesperson says to you, you look so sexy in that car. Wow, man, you're going to get a lot of dates. Things like that. Buying things is more emotional. Making decisions is very emotional. Information makes people think. Emotion makes them act.
Now, earlier you mentioned that 83% of, I guess, mergers and acquisitions don't go as the analysts predicted, right?
Right. And the investment bankers who get paid when the deal gets done.
So then would you consider those bad decisions?
It depends. They don't. Because they fail to deliver the expected results doesn't mean it's a failure. So let's say you project that you're going to improve your bottom line by, I don't know, 16% over a three-year period, and you do 12. That's not a disaster, but you have to balance that against what did it cost you to do the deal? What did it cost you to do financially? What did it cost you reputationally? And if you're an executive, what did it cost you reputationally with your board? So if you do a deal and it doesn't work so well, the next time you get all hot and excited for the next deal and you go to the board, they're like, yeah, well, you know, you told us that last one was going to be. In the worst case scenario, companies damage their reputations. I was brought into a situation a few years ago post-deal. I want to emphasize that post-deal. I was not there before they made the deal. And I was brought in literally after the deal closed, and the CEO said, go down to blah, blah, and look, snoop around and tell me what's going on. And I went down there, and I thought, these guys have no idea. They just bought a box of rocks. This is a disaster. Well, that deal resulted in the company being bankrupt in 18 months. So there were jobs lost, there were reputations tarnished, there were customers of these of this business who had a vastly poorer experience than they would have otherwise. And it was just a purely ego-driven, you know, let's try to eke out X percent, you know, points, basically, better on the return. And some of the investors came out very well, but it's heartbreaking when you think people lost their jobs.
So now, is the person that hires you, is it the CEO typically, or is it some of these M&A firms that are trying to get this right?
No, M&A firms don't hire me because they generally don't think of the deal the way I do. They think of the deal as a series of discrete things like financial analysis and due diligence. And once the deal is done, we're going to knit everything together. So we're going to weld it together. We have to get finance and HR and IT and sales and all of that. And
so they're looking
come together.
At each thing in a vacuum instead they look of holistically?
At each, yeah, they look at it as this plus this plus this. And they add it up. And what I like to say is don't let the technicians be the architects. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not the architect either, but I'm the architect advisor to whoever's responsible for making the deal a success. And helping that person see that if you don't look at it in a more cohesive way, you have a very mechanical process. And typically what happens is people put their heads down and they work really hard. Oh, let's get the IT systems to talk. That's important, right?
Sure.
I mean, you wouldn't ignore it. But if everybody's got their head down, what happens is you take your eye off your customer. And worse, you take your eye off the marketplace. And you don't see the faint signals about what are the needs in the marketplace. You all talk about it being problems. I usually talk about it being a market need. So what's the market need that we can meet that we're going to miss because our heads are down because we're busy knitting. And we look up and we go, look at this great sweater we knitted.
Right. Meanwhile, the IT works perfectly together.
Right. Meanwhile, the marketplace says, we don't want sweaters anymore. Right. You know, so it's a very human process, and the human process gets ignored. Or, and this is going to get some of your listeners to turn the radio off, it's handed to HR. And HR is an important piece because they have to knit the pipes together, have to get comp plans and pulled together. Then now this is assuming that you're bringing the companies together. You don't always have to do that. But the HR people are often also technicians. They may be very good, but don't let your technicians be architects. That's a big takeaway.
Yeah. Now, what about there are so many things that can be measured now. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the problem? Is just because it can be measured, maybe it isn't that important that we measure it?
Right. And people ignore measurement methods that are not quantitative. You know, so if it's not a number, and I think this is hilarious. I mean, as a psychologist, I think this is so hilarious that people say, well, this personality test is objective because I have numbers. And I'm like, and where did the data come from? If you take a personality test, it's your data. You're saying this about yourself.
Right.
So the objectivity comes from putting it through a bunch of statistical
screens.
But when
people see numbers, they must be true.
Right. They must be true. You know, so for example, if you're running a business and you, let's say you're in the middle of merging or not, it doesn't make any difference. And your sales are disappointing. I sometimes ask whether it's the CEO or the EVP of ops or whoever it happens to be, I say, you know, how many of your stores have you been in the last 6 months? And they go, what do you think they say?
None.
They say,
and then they think, and a really good operation.
That would be a good idea to go to some stores.
Yeah, but a really good operation like Home Depot, for example, the executives are in the stores, the board members are in the stores. And I think that's a great example of a company that realizes how much happens at the store level and that you can't just do a paint by numbers from corporate.
You can't just look at spreadsheets.
Exactly.
And dashboards.
Exactly. Right. So the deal that I told you about that where there was a bankruptcy, the investment bankers told the company that ended up being my client that the management team was very capable. And the reason that I had to go back to the CEO later and say, I didn't say this, but I was thinking you bought a box of rocks, is because there was no talent whatsoever. There was not a strategic bone in the building. This was a group of good operators who kept the business going because they knew their customers and they knew their routines. They didn't know how to grow it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were eventually going to go out of business anyway. This just accelerated it.
And that's
really
some
sad.
Of those times, that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
That all you've done is speed up their demise.
Exactly. Isn't that sad? That's a shame. And meanwhile, you know, some people walk away with millions of dollars.
Right.
That troubles me.
That troubles you?
Yes.
And
unless
the people
I'm one
that
of
them.
No, I'm checking.
So we've been talking, you know, about M&As and large organizations.
Right.
Lessons for small business, because I suspect there are some, right?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that because I'm currently talking to a smaller business. It's a retail operation, and they have less than 30 locations. And I'm talking to them because their sales are disappointing. And they've been disappointing. And I accidentally met a board member at a meeting and, you know, heard her talking about the disappointing sales. And I thought, oh, my God, no wonder, because I'm a customer. And the last time I went in the store, it was misery. It was absolute the experience had gone from being wonderful and lovely and one that I talked about to my friends,
right,
and sent my friends to, took my daughters to, you know, blah, blah. And it went from that to being, I felt like I walked in and the salespeople all but said, what do you want?
Right.
You're bothering us. We're stocking the shelves here, you know. So and that's also a good example of something that you don't know, except in hindsight. You don't know about customer experience until your sales numbers tell you it sucks. And that's it's already happened. You can't fix it. It's not prospective.
And it, is that sometimes because the manager or the owner has kind of tried to grow this maybe too rapidly and they're not physically in the store anymore, and so they're not seeing this with their eyes?
It could be that. It could be a number of things. So one of the things I do as a decision doctor is I perform a diagnosis. I take a history. So, one of the things in medicine that makes medicine so dangerous is, and now I'm going to annoy all the doctors, is the doctors don't listen very well. All the heads are nodding.
So, I concur.
Nod your head. Yes.
Yes.
Doctors don't listen. Now, okay, they're time pressured, and there's reasons why they don't listen. But if you want to make a good diagnosis, you pull the information, like the two of you talked about, pulling things from your clients. Patients will tell you what's wrong, but you have to listen. You have to create the opportunity for them to provide the information so you can guide them with questions. So I guide my clients with questions and find out what's going on. Then if I need more information, and sometimes I don't, then I go find out. So I might go visit a store. I might shop my potential client. So I might go online and try to buy something and see how easy it is or how difficult. I mean, this is not rocket science, right? It's pretty basic, but it's very systematic. Then I create a diagnosis and I say, this is your primary issue and this is a secondary issue. And then I say, and this is how to fix it as quickly as possible. And it could be management. In retail, it could be something I call presence. So in retail, you need three things. You need people, presence, and process. So you need the right talent. You need the right look and feel in the store and what that customer experiences. And you need the right process, which covers pretty much all that technical stuff, like do you have the right inventory and things like that.
So now what's the pain that a client is having before they say, I got to call the decision doctor?
It's disappointment in something. It's disappointment in sales results. It's disappointment in a person. Sometimes I get a call and I'm asked to coach a senior executive.
Sort of fix Bob.
Right. Exactly. And, it kind of reminds me of the days when I was a practicing psychotherapist many years ago. I'm fully recovered now. People would want to drop their 8-year-old child off at my office who was getting in trouble in class for throwing spitballs, and they wanted me to fix Billy. Same thing. Adults sometimes are kind of like 5-year-olds with briefcases, really. I mean, we can act that way. So sometimes that happens, and I have to do a history. I have to understand whether I diagnose whether or not the person has the capacity for change and if the organization will support the change. If those things aren't true, I'm not taking the work. I don't need the money. I don't need my reputation to be damaged. So,
So capacity to change, that's a make or break quality?
Yeah. And it's actually fairly easy to discover. Any of you could do it as well as I can. You ask people, you say, tell me.
Do you have the capacity to change?
Right. You ask them that. And then whatever they say, you write that down. No.
He said yes. No. So I guess he does.
No.
I've just been asking if the check would clear.
Yeah.
Well, that depends.
No, you ask them to talk about a time when they made a significant change in their life.
Uh-huh.
And then you ask them how they did it. And you ask them what was in their way, and you ask them how they overcame the obstacles. And what you note is what are the coping mechanisms they have intrinsically? What are the processes they created for themselves? So, for example,
what's a good example of somebody who gave the right answer?
Weight loss.
Okay, weight loss.
Somebody who successfully loses a significant amount of weight and keeps it off will be able to tell you what environment they've created for their life, what they've changed that allows them to keep the weight off. It's harder to keep weight off than to lose it.
Now, so
Subway,
if
a, I think is just
Subway.
So Jared is a rock star.
Yeah.
So what if they said the opposite? I have gained 50 pounds and I've managed to keep gaining weight. Is that change count? That capacity to change in that direction?
That's generally change that happens from lack of control, not control. But maybe they have some. Maybe they've haven't managed their weight, but they've done something else.
Like manage their money,
or started smoking.
Money.
Right.
Started
smoking.
Started
doing drugs.
Right. Look, I've changed a lot of things.
Yeah.
So you asked her earlier what causes them to call the decision doctor. Does it really work that way? Does your phone ring pretty consistently at this point in your career? Or is there an intentional sales and marketing outreach? Do you also have to or choose to go out and go find good, engaging products?
I do both. The majority of my business is referral. Mm-hmm. And it has been from the day I opened my doors, which is because the day I opened my doors, I'd been a management consultant for many years. So I was with a global firm for 12 years. I was a partner. I felt confident that I knew what I was doing, but I had a non-compete, so that was a little ugly for a while. But that worked out okay. But at this point, what I do is if there's something interesting happen, like if I I read about a deal last week in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm not going to mention it because I don't want anybody else, but it's two companies that I really admire, and they're going to come together. Mm-hmm. And so I've been on the phone calling people that I know that might be able to make an introduction to the chairman of the board or CEO or someone like that. And I would call them up and say, you know, I have the most successful track record of deal success of anyone, any consultant that I know of.
So these are two firms that recently merged, or
they announced their intention to come together. They're engaged,
right?
And the funny, I'm glad you said that, because the funny thing about deals is they are like courting. You know, you get to know each other, you have dinner, you drink a little too much. There's candlelight, your pupils dilate, and it's like, yeah, this can
Let's
be awesome,
do this.
You know. And you put your name on the line.
It's that
and
prenup,
then, and
that
then
kills
you're
you.
Right, and then you're courting, right? And so, you know, the other person comes to meet your parents, and before that happens, you have a maid come and clean up, and maybe you don't make all the food. You have a caterer, and everything is perfect. And then you get married, and what happens? You come home one day, so I'll be me, the woman. I come home one day, and I look on the floor, and there's damn dirty socks laying there. And it's like, wait a minute. When we were dating, you were so neat. You were so fastidious. Sorry, honey. You know, and then there's the dirty socks. So after the deal is actually concluded and people aren't selling themselves quite so much, and then you start seeing some of the things that you didn't see before. The people that hire me want to see that stuff sooner, mm-hmm. because I help them make visible what's invisible.
And then also you help them become aware that what you think is adorable now may not be so adorable a month from now.
You have no idea how true that is. You have no. In fact, when I was a therapist, I used to do marriage therapy, and I would have couples talk about when they would come in, what attracted them to each other. And guess how often the thing that attracts you is the thing that annoys you later.
Right.
What is the percentage?
83%.
It's close to 100. It's close to 100. Well, she was so bubbly and vivacious and cute in the life of the party. What's the current complaint? She won't shut up. It's the same thing.
Right.
It's the same thing.
It was just
and so
the
business,
prism they saw it in.
Business is similar. So, you know, one deal I worked on, it's, you know, the attraction was these folks are very buttoned up operationally. Well, what's the complaint? They're rigid. Same thing.
Right.
You know, that they didn't change their spots.
Now, you mentioned that some of this is like parenting or dating. Should you be getting your family and friends involved in your business? Is that a good play?
No. I'm going to say no, and there are examples of where that works. But just because there are exceptions to a rule doesn't mean you should ignore a rule or a standard. And the reason is that your friends and your family don't have the perspective that an expert from the outside will have. So I met with a guy, I guess 2 or 3 years ago. He owns a business here locally. It's a very successful business. It's family owned. The family's name is on the... I met with him twice because he wants to exit. He wants to take his money and go somewhere else.
He's the founder?
Yes. his son is not capable of running the business, he tells me, but he can't bring himself to tell his son that. And so what is he doing? He's having coffee with his buddies every, I don't know, Wednesday morning or whatever at some local place, and they have coffee, and they have become his advisors. And I called him yesterday and said, how you doing on that exit plan? No progress. So either his objective that he thinks he has is not really his objective, or he's just stubbornly clinging to this body of advisors who are not really helping him. What right. they're doing is they're complicating it for him. And a good advisor helps you simplify.
Right. So the clarity is coming back around. Huh?
Clarity is so incredibly important. And it takes about 3 seconds usually to help people figure out they don't have it. I usually ask people, because I talk about objectives a lot, and somebody sent me, a client sent me a meeting agenda yesterday, and I looked at it and I called him up and I said, what's your objective for the meeting? And he went,
We have a meeting every Wednesday.
Well, this is a strategy meeting. It's an annual strategy meeting. And I said, he said, well, what did you think about what I had on there? And I said, it doesn't matter what I think about what's on there, because until you have clear objectives, all options are arbitrary, period. So let's get your objectives clear. And it only took about 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But from that, once we pushed all the stuff, he had 2 pages of stuff. Once we pushed it through that screen, he had about 28% left. 28. Where did I get that? Let's call it 30.
You're very clear.
Math.
That's a lot
I'm
of clarity.
I'm very clear. I'm very specific.
It must be true,
really.
Then. It must be true. So if somebody has a big decision they're going through, or maybe they just went through, and they need help from the decision doctor, what's the best way of getting a hold of you?
The best way is to go to my website, which is cdconsultinggrp.com. If you type in CD Consulting Group, which obviously wasn't available when I went looking for it, you'll still come up with my company. I'm based in Atlanta, and I return all phone calls within 2 hours.
Wow. Even when you're in the middle of working with
Without
a client?
Fail.
You
right.
took a call in the middle of the show.
That's how, I did. You saw me. Rats. I've been outed. Darn it. No, I respond to all calls, because I find even a 2-hour meeting has a break.
Sure.
And you can get back to someone and say, I got your message. You know, could I call you at 4:30? And I think, you know, for any business owner, what I can tell you is if you respond to people quickly, you will be virtually alone. Because almost
that.
No one does that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Yeah, that was great fun.
All right. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.